Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the 33 Voices Dialogues. If you are a student of greatness, we have something very special for you today, because joining me from UC Berkeley is Professor Thinkers 50 Top Management and Leadership Thinker and co-author with Jim Collins of the amazing best-selling book Great by Choice is Morten Hansen to discuss his latest research, which is just as fantastic, on what it takes to be great at work. So, Morten, great to be with you.
Thank you for having me. It's a real privilege.
It's hard to believe that Great by Choice will be 7 years old today, or seven years old, I think, in October. So we're close to that. And it's also hard to believe that it was about 17 years ago that Jim's book came out, Good to Great. And I know that you had a lot of collaboration there. All of those things, what you guys have done together, I believe has changed the business vernacular with what it takes to be great at work. And before we dive into kind of the latest research, I'm curious from your perspective, a lot has changed in the world of business, especially with the modern startups that we just talked about. Is that framework as relevant today, Morten, as it was back then and certainly with Great by Choice?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it is. I think all of those frameworks are still relevant. We wrote Great by Choice to answer the question, how can companies and individuals thrive in a world full of change and turbulence? And since the publication of that book, the world has just become more uncertain, more turbulent, more disruptive. And the lessons then therefore still hold. They're perhaps even more relevant they are today than when that book came out.
Is there anything that you would change or update if you guys had to do an update on either one?
So on the Great by Choice, I think we focused on the how companies can cope with uncertainty. And I think one thing I would have changed is to add an additional chapter that would focus more on the early days of a startup. Because we actually traced all these great companies to way back when they started. And what we found was that they operated with these principles since their founding days. But we could have spent an additional chapter explaining that.
And what would you say, like, if you were sitting and talking to 20 founders today about those timeless principles that you guys talk about that would assist them in improving the odds of their current startups succeeding, what would you make sure they remember?
I think there is a principle across these books and also in the last one, which is what I call do less than obsess, which is, as a startup, you got very limited resources. You cannot do everything. In fact, what you can do is just a tiny set of priorities. So you need to do less. You need to zoom in on the very few things that matter. And then you need to go all in on those things because execution matters. So you can't please all the customers. You got to be able to say no. You got to know what is that real kernel that you're trying to execute on, and then go all in and executing. The moment you start spreading yourself thin, the moment you start having more sort of bloated offices and product line gets more bloated, you're in trouble.
Well, we're going to get, that's kind of the core principle of the new book, and I'm going to dive into that in a moment. But what I thought would be important for our audience to hear from you is you have been a student of greatness yourself for a long time, really ever going back to the days of this, the projects that you did with Jim. How do you recognize somebody who is great at what they do?
First of all, we look at obviously the outcomes, but that can be a bit deceiving. So you say, have they done great things? Are they successful? But that doesn't predict greatness. That just is a way of finding it and identifying what it is. Obviously, you need to go back and ask, you know, what did they do on the road to greatness, and how was that different from what other people did who didn't achieve that? Because if you only look at successful, great people, you're not looking at the opposite, what differentiated them from less successful ones. What I look for, if I talk to someone, is the question is, are they very clarity about what they're trying to accomplish? In other words, are they that focus? The second thing is, do they have a great team around them? And are they rigorous in assembling that team? Because greatness is not so much an individual pursuit. When you see one great person, in business in particular, there's usually a great team behind it.
Sure.
And so you've got to look at that. Are they, in other words, are they thinking about going beyond themselves? That they understand the limitation of their own genius, so to speak, and they're able to get that great team and make the most of that team. And I think when you have problems with that, it's a big worry. And we see some startups that they're blowing up. I mean, look at Uber. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The whole management team blew up. They had to rebuild the management team.
When you're around these greats, Morton, and they answer these two questions, certainly that they're crystal clear on the path and the pursuit and the purpose, and they have a superb team around them. Getting back to the built to last days or building an enduring company, how do these types of individuals continually keep at that pace? How do they maintain that sense of level five humility, despite the fact that we live in a crazy uncertain world right now?
Yeah, I think there are two answers to that. One is when you become successful, that's when you start believing in too much in yourself and your own genius. So you lose that humility. So you think you're invincible. You think you can start doing things and you start cutting corners. And that is quite dangerous. So you think you have to know the answer to things. So you just go ahead as opposed to, say, starting with an experiment or a pilot to find out what might work, because you believe in so much in your own judgment. That's a very dangerous thing. Hubris is a very dangerous thing among leaders. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, you know, people are successful and continue to have lasting impact. They continuously reinvent themselves. And if you go back and look at the first piece of research, Built to Last, by Jim Collins and Jerry Porras, and the first project I worked on, that is perhaps the most important concept presented in that book. And in today's world, where things change so fast, you got to have that reinvention machine all the time. And that's difficult for companies because they become good at one thing, so they keep on delivering on that one thing. But in addition, you need to also start developing new things. And you need to do those two things at the same time. You're going to please your current customer, what you had to offer, and you're going to find new offerings. And it's that twin engine that you need.
Well, let's dive into the latest research. And you've already mentioned the first principle, which I think is the heart of everything that we're going to talk about. This whole idea of do less than obsess. That makes total sense to me. Was it a surprise to you, especially knowing what the work that you had done in the past?
What was a surprise to me is some nuance of that principle, which you could sort of say is maybe the secret sauce of that principle. So let me just unpack it. We have already been told that you should focus, right? There are books out there saying focus. Yeah, sure. What do you really mean are choosing a few things to work on, choosing your priorities. It's a choice. It's a matter of choice. And as long as you have chosen something, then things will work out for you. And when I looked at my research, I thought, well, that's the first thing I'm going to test. That's a reasonable hypothesis. And probably those who are more focused would do better than those who are not. So we tested that. And we found, yes, but it doesn't explain superior performance. It explains being good versus bad. What the great performers did is that they also obsessed. In other words, they were able to say, yes, I'm going to focus on a few things, but I'm going to dedicate my effort I'm going to obsess over excelling in those few things. And that means paying incredible attention to details, being fanatic around the quality, and making sure I have superb execution. And it turns out that that is a rare combination. In our data set of 5,000 people, about 17%, so less than 1 in 5, excelled at that combination. And then when we run those numbers across the data set to figure out who is a top performer, that combination is what makes a top performer. So focusing, choosing alone does not. And it's a bit of a harsh requirement if you think about it. First of all, you've got to be able to prioritize really well. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't. And there are reasons for that. You know, maybe they have a boss that gives them too many things to do. So it's difficult to really focus on a few things. And then in addition, you have to go and say, well, now I have to obsess over those few things. And so I need to do two things well. But that is the path to success.
Well, the first thing that I started to think about as I read the details of that are superb athletes. When you think of superb athletes who are singularly focused on being sincerely being the best at what they do, you can tell the difference between them and everybody else.
Absolutely. I think athletes are a superb example of this. And you will notice in most sports, athletes tend to be incredibly specialized. I used to be a track and field runner myself. You find a real great athlete is specializing in one or two events. They're not sort of running all the events. They're not generalists. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you can't be a generalist and be superb. So usually they are really, really good in a few things. And they're incredible in their execution. And the thing is that in the workplace, I guess I was surprised to see that so many people are the opposite. And I call it the do more paradigm of work, which is we are looking at our day and week and we say, how many things can I do? How many items can I put on my to-do list given the amount of time I have? And we try to fill up the to-do list with more and more. And our bosses and managers give us more to do. And so we figure out how many tasks and assignments can I take on in order to excel. It's the opposite. And then we say, okay, can I work harder? I can put in more hours. So we keep on putting in more and more hours. And we think that by putting in more hours and doing more things, we're going to be better performers. And it's not true. It's just plain wrong that the best performers are more contrarians almost. They say, I'm going to go the other way. I'm going to find a few things that really matter here, mission critical things, and I'm going to go all in on those and say no to the rest.
So, Morton, when you look at the high potential leaders, entrepreneurs out there who are fighting to get their place, whether it's in an established business or a fast-growing startup, what advice do you have for them or for their senior leaders on how to get the best out of them? You know, if somebody's building something special, inevitably they're juggling a lot of balls. And in your case, you were very open about sharing your case that, hey, you bought a new computer, you went to Starbucks for 2 hours uninterrupted every day, you got rid of your web browser, and that's how this book is in our hands.
Yeah, I mean, the temptations, the number of distractions around you, and that's true for a startup founder, it's true for a startup team, and it's true for me, it's just incredible. And we react to things that are in front of us. So there are messages coming in. There are emails coming in. If you're on Slack, you know, any other kind of program, Basecamp, Asana, whatever it is, there are all these things coming at you and you start reacting to it. And before you know it, half a day has gone by or hours have gone by and you haven't really done what matters the most. You're responding to what is in front of you, which tends to be urgent, perhaps not important. So you got to find a way of carving out that time and disciplining yourself. And being a bit vulnerable with yourself and say, I am as prone to these temptations as anyone else. And that's what I was starting writing this book. you know, it requires discipline. You need to be able to put 3 hours aside every day and say, I'm going to write. Now, if you are sitting on your computer and that computer is being bombarded with pings about incoming, really fun things you want to respond to, it's hard to discipline yourself. So I did this kind of modern version of tying yourself to the mast, you know, which is this idea that you tie yourself to the mast ahead of time so you're not distracted by these beautiful sirens that come and want to tempt you away. And I stripped my computer of everything, emails, text messaging programs, all kinds of apps. And I just had one thing on it, a word processing document. And then I went to Starbucks. So I could not. There might have been temptations, but I have blocked myself from those temptations. And I, you know, it's funny, I see that kind of principle in some startup worlds too. I saw this interesting thing in an office landscape here the other day. So they have invented a very simple method, which was that if you were did not want to be disturbed, you were wearing a red kind of bracelet, rubber bracelet on your hands. And you could not go and disturb them. That was the free time. That was a signal, you know, stay away from me. I'm working on something important. I don't want to be disturbed. It's a trivial mechanism, but, you know, it tells people, you know, don't interrupt me. I'm working on something important. We know from research that interruptions are actually much more damaging than we think. It's not the 30-second, one-minute help because you have to switch out of your current task. You have to listen to somebody who's asking you something, say in the office, they're sticking your head into your cubicle or you know, in front of you. And then you have to refocus again on what you were doing. And you're losing really valuable time. So there are these small things you can do to carve out the time that you need. I mean, that's a really important part of this.
Well, one of the things I think is also critical, and your second principle really reminds me of a lot of the conversations I've had in the world of design thinking. You know, it's easy to say do less, but what do we focus on? Your second principle is redesigning what we do, which is so important. Mm. How do we start to do that?
Yeah, I think if you're going to do less, you better work on the right things, right? If you work on the wrong things, then you're just you're going off a cliff. The question, what we found that the best performers, they have answered one crucial question. What is the value that I create? So for a startup, it is, what is the critical value we are creating? And by that, I mean a very precise thing. It is the value for your customers. So if you're a startup, you've got to answer the question, what is the true value we're bringing to our customers? It's not value for ourselves. So the metrics you have to look at are metrics of value for customers, not your own metrics of success. So take an example. Take Slack, the communication messaging app that is so successful. Most people at Slack look at two metrics of success for Slack, which is the number of users and the engagement of those users. In other words, the number of hours that they are using this program while they're working. And investors love those numbers because they're skyrocketing. So it looks like Slack is incredibly successful. But those are measures of Slack's value for themselves, not for the customer. So if you go to the customer side, like say a company of 2,000 people and they are on Slack. Okay, the question then is, if they're using Slack in that company, are they getting more productive as a result of using that software program? That's value. Now, so Slack then have to go in and measure the value. Are these customers using Slack more productive? And the fact that they're using it, the number of hours they're on it, is not the same as productivity. That's almost as saying that the number of meetings we have is a measure of productivity versus the number of hours you're spending on Slack is a measure of productivity. It isn't. That's the difference between value and just your own internal metric.
And so that takes a far greater commitment, Morten. I mean, you talk about, you know, back to the Intuit days where they have to sit in front of people and see how much impact their product is having and how exactly they're using it, that's when you know you have a real customer-centric company.
Absolutely. It's the customer centricity where you define the value according to the terms of the customers. What is the problem you're helping them solve? And I have a sense that in today's startup world, people easily lose sight of that because they're so focused on growth of user base and growth of usage of their software program or whatever service they're providing. But those are not necessarily measures of value. And I think there is the question that a founder and a startup team need to answer themselves is, what is the true value we are bringing to our customer, defined as the benefit we bring to customers?
So when you sat down to redesign what you do, so you can kind of follow that first paradigm, do less and obsess, how did you do it?
So, you know, it's a great question, because one of the things you'll learn when you're doing a book like this is you're asking yourself the question, well, how am I doing according to these principles? Because if I study these top performers, you got to sort of look at yourself in the mirror and saying, how well am I doing these things? And I scored myself sort of midway through the process. And basically what I found is that I'm not as good as I need to be on some of these principles. The do, lend, and obsess, I felt that I was spreading myself too thin. And so what I did is that I tried to kind of cut out the number of things that I was doing. And then you have to say, okay, redesign. How are you changing the way that you work? And the things that you do. So, for example, I had dabbled in my own sort of developing applications, apps for work productivity, and that started draining my time. And I was thinking, hey, wait a minute, is that really my key value that I bring? I mean, others can do that far better than I can. So I stopped doing that, and I sort of said, okay, I'm going to pull back. And I'm going to look at what is the value I can bring. And then I decided, well, you know, doing research and creating evidence-based principle that can help others be more successful in their lives, that's one thing I can do. And so I better, if that's the one value that I can bring, then I better focus on that and redesign what I do in order to deliver on that. And that's what I'm doing more of now. And I think that's a refocusing on my effort that we all have to go through, because we get so many opportunities in front of you and we easily get distracted by other things.
Of course. Do you feel a different level of fulfillment?
Yeah, so that brings me to the other principle is when you think of working really hard on a few things that you think matter, it better be something you care about. And I have this principle of combining passion and purpose. And the one, I think, misconception out there is that you should do what you love, right? Follow your passion, and everything else will take care of itself. And that's partially wrong. And by that I mean it's what excites you is hedonistic. It's you might be extremely excited about something that no one else really care about, but you do it because it excites you. You might create a great project because you think it's, you just love kind of doing it and it's a great engineering challenge or whatever you're doing, but it doesn't mean it makes any contribution. Purpose is the opposite of passion. Purpose is do what contributes, meaning to others. So you need the greatest performers in my data set have both passion, they love what they're doing, and they have purpose. They do what contributes in terms of what they find meaningful, but it's a real contribution. So for me, it is to create this management and self-management principle that enable people to be great at work and through that contribute to the world. And I see that as my purpose, and I need to judge myself on how well I deliver on that purpose. But that gives me the drive to do this.
Well, isn't it, you know, again, your work gives you a front row seat with the world's elite performers, leaders, famous individuals, athletes, whatever. And undoubtedly, that group of people, because of the level of success they've achieved, they've gotten really, really good at what they do. So it's probably easier for them to follow your passion because they probably live in a world where that's what they're doing every day. But what most of us miss is what it took to get there.
Yeah, but when I speak to a lot of those people, I also find that they had it early on when they were not successful. So they kind of found this little, think about it as a sweet spot in their lives. Basically, a few things, do less than obsess, that creates a lot of value that they care deeply about. That's a sweet spot. And they found that early on, before they were successful. And that's why it's that combination that you got to find when you are on the way to, hopefully, to success. It's never guaranteed. It's just a chance. But you're going to find that early on. Because what we found in my data set is that this predicts success, performance. It's not, and here is, you know, it's wrong to look at very successful people and they will come and tell you, you know what, I'm really passionate and therefore you should follow your passion. Mm-hmm. But that's wrong, because what you have not looked at are unsuccessful people who also follow their passion. So following your passion can take you to road to ruin. I mean, go to Hollywood and look at the failed actors and actresses in Hollywood. They follow their passion, right? You can't ask, you know, a successful actress, you know, like Meryl Streep, whether she followed her passion. Of course she did. But what about the other thousands and thousands down there in LA? And so you need to look at finding a kernel of purpose and passion. And that's why I think everybody, all of us, should ask ourselves these questions every day. And it's a hard work. It's a simple concept, but it's kind of hard work. And people need to kind of start changing what they do and not just to be stuck in a specific career path.
Well, it's definitely not an on and off switch, but I want you to talk to those people out there who have not experienced this principle of P squared, which is what you call passion plus purpose. And for whatever reason, Morton, they can't leave their job, whether they're senior leaders or founders or whatever. What do you tell them so they can start to get this equation to work better for them?
Right. So first of all, a very important finding is that many of the people in our data set, it's not like they left their job or their profession. Right? So it's not like you have to quit your job and go work for a nonprofit to find purpose in life. It's just not, it's not that, right? So for the passion, the one advice I have is to look at, think of passion more broadly, and is to say, all right, what is that I love doing? Okay, you can put that down. What is my current job that really excites me? What kind of people do I want to be with? There's a people passion. There is a social passion, okay? What are people I don't want to be with? They give me no excitement. They don't give me any energy, all right? So you sort of say, okay, I like to hang out with those kinds of people and not these kinds of people. Then it's success passion, which is the thrill of success. Am I interested in that? You know, the adrenaline and going in and winning or getting a sales or whatever it is. Does that drive me? If it does, okay, write it down. There are these different kinds of passion. We have a too narrow definition of passion. Then it's the learning passion. Well, do I actually like enjoying getting to know more things? Do I go into training seminar that is really well done and I like it? So now, okay, I have a learning passion. So I sort of write down on a piece of paper what kind of gives you energy, what excites you, and what doesn't. And once you got that, then start thinking, okay, so what is it I can do that is going to give more passion in the daily life? I'm expanding my passion circle. I'm going to take the people. So if there are certain people that really, they excite me, they give me more energy, can I hang out more with them? Can I work more with them? Can I find projects or assignments with them? And then avoid the ones who drain energy from you. You know, there are those people, you go and meet with them and you leave the meeting and you just feel more pessimistic, feel more drained.
Yeah. And they're the worst.
They are the negative people around you. They give you no energy. Well, you know, if that is important to you, the people passion, stay away from those. Find a way not to. I'll give an example. When I was doing my PhD studies at Stanford, there was one brilliant professor. And every time I went to his office, I left drained with energy. Right? He sort of said all the things I couldn't do. Then there was another person, professor by the name of Jeff Pfeffer. Every time I met him, I left the room, you know, with an extra, you know, sprint in my legs and mm-hmm. feeling great. And I decided to ask him to be my thesis chair because that person gave me energy. Even though they were both brilliant, I could have picked the other guy. But when you have choices like that, you know, go for the ones that give you energy. That's on the passion side. On the purpose side, I think we got purpose all wrong. We think of purpose as a social purpose. You got to save, you're going to contribute to poverty or save the homeless people in the streets of Chicago, whatever, sort of those kinds of more social missions. But, you know, purpose starts with do what contributes to others. In other words, creating value. So what I ask people here is that look at your job and say, what is the one thing you're doing in your job today that creates the most value for others? It could be for your organization. It doesn't have to be for customers. It could be for another department. If you're working in human resources, then it's, you know, what value do you give the rest of the organization because you're providing an internal service? Okay? And you're going to ask that, what is that value? And then you ask a second question, which is, what is it I could be doing that I'm not currently doing that would create a lot of value for others? And when you have, and maybe it's something very simple that you haven't thought about, see if you can add that to your job. So you take those two things, and that's really the purpose, because it's contribution to your organization. And if you can answer those two questions, then you're sort of getting on the road to a greater purpose. And that's the idea here, is that there are small changes along the way that actually add up to a lot on these two, in these two concepts here.
And it's really kind of redesigning and reframing our definition of passion and purpose. A couple more things I want to make sure we touch on before we end. One of the things that you mentioned earlier is the whole idea of continually reinventing ourselves. And that's become a cliche. It's become business vernacular. But from your research, what does it take to become a great learner?
So I think most of us, and I will include myself in this, are poor learners at work. And because what we do is that we do mindless repetition. So here's the one thing that I ask managers when I'm in front of them. I say, how many meetings are you running per day or in per day? Usually the number is quite large, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of meetings.
All
a lot
of us. Yeah.
There are too many meetings. Okay, they say maybe two. I if you're a manager, they say I'm run two meetings a day on average. Okay, I said that's 10 a week, right? If you run two, right? That's 10 a week. And then you got 50 weeks, that's 500 a year. That's 1,500 meetings over 3 years. I got a ton of meetings, and that's maybe a conservative number. And I said, okay, in those meetings, presumably how well you run them is going to matter for the quality of your work, whether you're great or not. Yeah, sure. Okay, so how much are you practicing running them better? In other words, are you taking a chunk of a meeting, whether it's setting a better agenda, whether it is asking better questions as a manager, whether it's making the more quiet people to speak up, whether it is to drive for consensus in decision-making, whatever principle that constitutes a great meeting. Are you actually taking some of those principles and saying, I'm going to isolate that practice, and then I'm going to try to improve on it every time I run a meeting? And that means try out something new, tweak the practice, ask a different question in a meeting, get some feedback. Did it work better? Did it create better debate because I asked a better question, or more focused debate because it was a more directed question? And then measure the outcome. Okay, we had a better meeting, better quality decision. And if not, I'm going to tweak it some more. In other words, it's a learning loop. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that athletes are following these principles. This is where they excel at. When they practice, they do intense practice. Mm-hmm. They're not just standing there and just hitting a golf ball mindlessly or swinging the tennis racket or whatever sport we're talking about. They isolate maybe the serving, and then they spend 3 hours exhaustively getting that feedback on every serve to make sure it's getting better. We don't do that at work. Those who do, you see their learning rate just shoot up. They're just becoming better.
Well, you use a great example in the book about, you know, I think just use Roger Federer with, you know, when you compare how he practices with kind of what we're used to in the normal performance review world where, hey, once a year his coach comes to him and say, hey, we need to improve your serve this year as compared to how we get it. That's where the disconnect starts.
Absolutely. Annual performance reviews are really broken because they don't help us to become better. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, you know, athletes don't get a feedback once a year. I mean, it's absurd, right? That's kind of what we do. So what you need is continuous informal feedback and sort of have the courage to kind of ask your colleagues for feedback in a meeting. How did I contribute in that meeting? Did I ask good questions? Were my comments succinct and well delivered, or were they sort of like all over the place? And get that feedback and then tweak your practice. Now you're running informal, continuous feedback every day in the office. And the thing about it that is so powerful is that this does not take a lot of time.
Absolutely.
I call it the sort of the 50 minute a day. And if you're trying to improve your performance in meetings, you're in those meetings anyway. You just have to be a little more reflective of what you're doing. And maybe a little more preparation, but it's sort of that 15 minute a day. It's nothing more than that.
Morton, two more questions before I let you go. How has the level 5 leader you've been around continually getting the best out of his or her people?
I mean, that's a great question. I think one of the great things that level 5 leaders do, and let's define it, it's a leader who is subordinating his or her own personal agendas in favor of a great company mission. And they have the humility to match that. That's a level 5 leader definition. Those level 5 leaders I have observed are better at getting better people around them. And why is that? Great people, they don't want to work for someone who's just out to enrich and promote him or herself. They want to work for something bigger and more important, like a company mission or a great cause of a company. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I don't work with Tesla, but I could just imagine you can join Tesla because you are such in awe of Elon Musk, or you can join Tesla because you believe in the mission of that company. And I bet that is the great people. That is the primary reasons why they are joining it.
And he himself, that's probably his prime reason.
Right. I think it is. And here's a leader who's incredibly charismatic, but it's not about him. First and foremost, it's not about him. It's about the mission of the company. And the moment it's about the leader, right? I'm here to make that leader richer and more successful, then the best people leave. Why would you do that anyway? If you're great, if you're really talented, or if you're not, you know, whoever. Why would you work for someone where the primary purpose is to enrich that person? And that's a benefit level 5 people have because it's not about them. Mm-hmm. We have too many people are there just to enrich themselves. I'm meaning that in terms of promoting themselves, and it's about their greatness. It's not about what they're trying to do together.
Lastly, I want to ask you about your last book. Your last book was about collaboration, and one of the observations that I see that's a direct correlation, at least in my opinion, to great teams is their ability to communicate and to collaborate, maybe to do the disciplined collaboration that you're talking about. What is missing in most organizations you work with that bridges that gap between too much communication, too little communication?
Yeah. Collaboration, I wrote that book some years ago. Collaboration has become even more important than when I wrote it. It's probably one of the most difficult things to get right in companies today, whether you're a small company, large company, or, you know, look at Congress, the U.S. Congress, right? It's so hard. And one problem people have is that they over-collaborate. So, you know, of course, they can under-collaborate. They're not talking across silos in the company, and that's a problem. And then you've got people who are just collaborating too much. They're in all kinds of meetings and all kinds of task forces, and it's just over-collaboration. Again, you have to answer. I think the one thing you have to get right in collaboration, where people, I think, are really struggling, is to ask the question, what is the most valuable collaborations that we can do? And let's select that small set of activities, and let's not focus on the other kinds of collaboration, the old task forces and meeting across, but let's focus on the few. And if you are able to do that, then it becomes easier because now you can free up all the resources and all the time you have on those few things, those few collaborations. And I have seen in companies, they might have a list of 50 collaboration projects that they want to be doing. And I always ask them, well, what's the three most important? Okay, well, you know, cut off the bottom of the list and do those three and go all in on those three. Again, it's that do list obsessed principle applied to collaboration. Mm-hmm. I think that is the key thing in companies to have to ask that, you know, what's the business case for those collaborations? Because there are many things you can collaborate on. It's nice. But let's be a little more brutal here and saying, what's the real business case for this collaboration? And once we answer that, focus on that. I think that's my best advice. And I think I know from having worked for lots of companies that that collaboration list is oftentimes too bloated.
Yeah, and it's something that becomes glaring when you walk into an organization. But most importantly, I am in your debt for the amazing work that you continue to do. I know of no other individual who's as active in this pursuit of greatness as you are. So I appreciate it. I look forward to building on these conversations. But for everyone else out there, how do they get more connected with the work that you're doing around this idea?
So the best place to go to learn more about the latest research is my website, which is www.mortenhansen. Let me spell that mortenhansen.com. And there we have some resources for you. You can sign up and get a newsletter that I publish. And you can also go and get a pre-order instruction for the book, Great at Work, if you want to. And so we have some resources there for you to learn more.
Outstanding. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's a real privilege of being on your program.